Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with the veteran choreographer Paul Taylor. His world-renowned dance company will visit Philadelphia for a series of performances at the Annenberg Center. Susan Lewis looks at the upcoming annual poetry conference at Westchester University, now in its 14th year. Jason Pfeiffer visits the People's Light and Theatre as it stages, "I have before me a remarkable document given to me by a young lady from Rwanda." The play was written in response to playwright Sonia Linden's interactions with refugees of the 1994 Rwandan genocide. And David Patrick Stearns considers the harpsichord. Brandywine Baroque's Dumont Concert Series features performances on some beautifully restored rare and antique harpsichords. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Despite being, by his own admission, a late bloomer, the now legendary American choreographer Paul Taylor has been performing or creating dance for more than half a century. He was in his third year of a swimming scholarship, studying painting at Syracuse University, when he experienced a dance recital. There and then, quote, it just hit him. He left Syracuse for New York City to begin studying at Juilliard, and within 4 years he was dancing for such luminaries as Martha Graham and George Balanchine, and had founded his own Paul Taylor Dance Company. In the 50-plus years since then, Taylor has attracted deep admiration and great controversy. His choreographic innovations, such as using common gestures, have evolved from a personal vernacular into the everyday language of dance. Some of the subjects of his work, marital rape, American imperialism, and incest, have sometimes overshadowed the larger body of his work, which has been, by and large, masterful. Since March, the Paul Taylor Dance Company and the smaller Taylor 2 troupe have been on a statewide tour of Taylor's native Pennsylvania, performing in 18 cities and towns. The tour ends this week with a series of performances at the Zellerbach Theatre in West Philadelphia. I met with Paul Taylor at his studio in New York City earlier this week. So what was the original dance impulse? Was it a kinetic feeling? Was it responding to music?
I like to move. I just want to be a dancer, you know.
It came to you later than some people in this day and age when we have kids having dance lessons at 4 and 5. You were in your teens.
I was in my third year of college. Yeah, I got a late start. I had a lot of, you know, catching up to do. So I left college immediately and came to New York and enrolled in Juilliard and took, you know, a lot of classes every day.
What was that moment when you knew this was what you meant to do? Do you remember it? Was it an epiphany, a road to Damascus? You said, I'm a dancer.
Well, I knew I wanted to be one, and I felt pretty confident. It just hit me. It just hit me. I thought I wanted to be a painter, and I'd gotten a little tired of painting classes. They were teaching us to paint like Matisse, and I didn't really want to paint like Matisse. And I loved to move. You know, I was there on an athletic scholarship. And I thought, dance, that sounds good. I think I'll do that.
So athletics and artistic expression wrapped into one. Was there a connection between the swimming, the athleticism, and the desire for creative expression?
Well, as a performer, I remembered how it felt to push through water, to use water, and use the eddies and the currents and the backwash and everything as a swimmer. So when I started dancing, I loved that feeling, and a lot of my movement, particularly if it was slow movement, I pressed through, using all my muscles for doing something that didn't require that much energy, really. But I liked doing that, yeah.
When, in those days, you were creating new work, what was driving it? Was it music? Was it wishing to tell a story, or was it just the kinetic impulse?
Oh, well, the music, of course, and if I had any idea about a story element, there was that, and visually, you know, to make a picture, a framed picture, proscenium's like a frame, like a painting, and use of spatial patterns. Sometimes a little mathematics comes into it, or architecture. Yeah.
And the fact that you were along the way inventing your own language that has now become a part of the vernacular, the smaller, more discreet gestures, the non-traditional dance steps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was that element of natural movement that I got interested in.
What's needed of, or is there a priority for a Paul Taylor dancer? Is it all about technique? Is it all about the body, the strength, the ability to carry this work?
I think it's basically about passion, or should be. And you know, dancers these days are technically a lot better than my generation. And of course, it's needed. It's a given. But the passion for dance and the ability of a dancer to communicate different things as whatever the dance requires is of major importance.
And therefore, any body type, not any degree of technical ability, I would imagine.
No, I know if somebody's fat, 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 that's out. I mean, maybe somebody would want to make a whole company of really, you know, overweight people. But I don't. I haven't done. That's one thing I haven't done yet. So their looks are important, of course. They have to, you know, look like gods and goddesses, in my mind.
Over the years, you have stirred proper society into outrage often by the subject matter of your dances and even your use of music. When everything was avant-garde, you decided you were going to go back to Baroque music. You were going to just keep moving the goalposts. Was that purposeful, or was that just what you felt at the time?
I try not to follow trends, you know, and I like to challenge myself and try for something that I haven't tried. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I never set out to enrage people, you know. On the other hand, if someone really objects strongly to something, it means I've gotten through in some way.
You know? Choreographer Paul Taylor. The Paul Taylor Dance Company completes its Pennsylvania tour this week with performances at the Zellerbach Theatre in West Philadelphia from Thursday through Sunday.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The warm weather can draw fragrant blossoms from their buds, full-bodied songs from the tiniest of birds, and otherwise solitary writers from their cloisters to engage in workshops and conferences that sprout like perennials around the country. Typically, aspiring and seasoned novelists, non-fiction writers, and poets converge on a campus for several days for talks, readings, and a workshop or two. A Philadelphia area campus lays claim to an atypical event as these things go, the largest annual conference in the country devoted exclusively to poetry, and the only one dedicated to teaching the poets traditional tools of meter, rhyme, and narrative. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis explores why this conference is important not only to the poets in our midst, but also to the rest of us.
I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me, and what can be the use of him is more than I can see.
I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree.
Come live with me and be my love, and we will some new place.
Most of us can recite some favorite verse from somewhere in our young lives, from a nursery rhyme or the playful banter of Dr. Seuss to a love sonnet from John Donne or William Shakespeare. But many of us, somewhere between childhood and the serious business of making a life, lost our comfort with and appreciation for poetry as an art form, except for those moments, sad or joyous, when ordinary prose just won't do. At those times, we may look for some sort of expression that strikes a chord within us.
My father read me poetry when I was very little, so I always was sort of hypnotized by the rhyme.
Katrina Rutt earned her master's in English, but she didn't start out to be a poet.
In my undergraduate career, I moved away from it. And then when I got to graduate school and had a real opportunity to specialize in something, I realized that I had to do what I was obsessed with.
Fascination, if not obsession, also afflicted the young Michael Pike.
I was a college athlete, and when we would go to competitions, I would sit in the back of the bus, and I would read Ginsberg, and I would read Corso, and I was large enough that nobody on the football team would make fun of me.
Pike put down his football for the pen and became an English teacher. Today, he calls himself a reader of poems, not a poet. But through his love of poetry, and in his work publishing new poetry on the Hand Book Press he founded at Westchester University, he's met a lot of writers, among them poet Dana Gioia, who now serves as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. The two men became friends, sharing a love of verse and song. One night, they became intoxicated with the idea of bringing together like-minded literary types.
Nowhere in this country did we know of a place where one could learn about traditional craft.
They outlined the ways in which this conference would be different from all the rest.
We would focus on the traditional craft of poetry and narrative. We would bring in critics and scholars so that we would develop what became the third purpose, a community.
The first year, 1995, about 90 people showed up, but it generated so much excitement that they did it again the next year, and the next. Now, Pike says, the conference at the Westchester University campus draws about 300 people from all over the world. The community includes poets starting out, like Katrina Rutt, patriarchs of the art form, like former U.S. Poet Laureate and multiple award winner Richard Wilbur, and lots of people in between. Poet April Lidner teaches at St. Joseph's University. This will be her ninth year at the Westchester Conference.
The first time I came to Westchester, I was actually somewhat reluctant to be there. I was a committed free verse poet, but I heard a lot of poetry that was some of the most interesting I'd heard in a long time, and I have come to think of all the elements of formal verse as being essential to a poet's toolkit.
Just what should be in that poet's toolkit has been the subject of some debate. Poetry, like other art forms, changed in the 20th century, both in content and style. Romanticism and traditional techniques gave way to modernism and experimenting with different forms, or in some cases, no apparent form at all. In the 80s, new formalism emerged as an identifiable trend and was seen as a gauntlet thrown down to the academic establishment of the time, says Lidner.
Poetry's mainstream, the academic poets who'd been writing free verse and nothing but for a very long time, felt a bit defensive about new formalism. And so there were hard feelings for a long time.
This conference does take the position that tools of rhyme, verse, and narrative are worth knowing, whether you write in that style or not. But the gathering aims not to divide people, but to draw them together, says Michael Pike. Poets who write poetry, critics who write about poetry, and a third group.
People who just love poetry. They just simply come to listen, absorb, and enjoy.
Art songs, written to give musical voice to a specific text, seemed a logical addition to the conference, especially a conference going back to basics. April Lidner says poetry began with song.
The original poets were troubadours who brought the news from village to village, and so the poetry had to be memorable so that they could memorize it. So poetry's origins are in song and in the oral.
In this excerpt from the 2005 conference, Barbara Quintiliani sings the music of Laurie Lateman, set to Dana Gioia's poem, The Song. This year, the musical component is a concert featuring songs from a new opera based on The Scarlet Letter. On Wednesday night, Richard Wilbur will give the keynote reading. Poetry readings on subsequent evenings will feature Dana Gioia, Molly Peacock, and A.E. Stallings, among others. The conference, now in its 14th year, is not simply to build an insular community. Michael Pike says the Poetry Center continues to look for ways to bring poetry to the general public.
What we're in the process of doing now is producing a number of poetry documentaries where poets read and discuss their work. We're hosting a children's poetry conference. We just keep trying to expand our outreach.
Westchester, with its conference and outreach, is doing its best for poetry. The question is, what does poetry do for us? Katrina Rutt has one answer.
I think for me, poetry is a way of slowing down time. Society today is kind of working on a hyper-paced level of activity. And when I write poetry, when I attend the conference, I feel like it's sort of time outside of time.
For the rest of us, it's worth remembering that poetry need not be something academic or foreign. It's one of our first introductions to the world. Whether in a formal reading or a bedtime story, it's there for the taking, in our memories, our speech patterns, our music, in the beat of our hearts. As surely as it calms us in crisis, it may help us navigate the challenges of everyday life.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Westchester Poetry Conference runs this Wednesday through Saturday at the Poetry Center at Westchester University. Evening readings are free and open to the public. In 1994, over the course of about 100 days, at least 800,000 Rwandan Tutsis were systematically murdered by members of the country's Hutu population. The genocide displaced thousands of Rwandans, refugees forced to forge new lives and tried to come to terms with the tragedy. The People's Light and Theatre in suburban Philadelphia is now presenting a play that explores the experience of Rwandan refugees and takes inspiration from the stories of others. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the production highlights the power of writing and storytelling in the most trying of circumstances.
Sonia Linden's 2003 drama has a title that often raises eyebrows and grabs attention. I have before me a remarkable document given to me by a young lady from Rwanda. It's derived from a line in the play spoken by the protagonist, Juliet. Speaking by phone from London, Sonia Linden says she, in large part, modeled Juliet on a young lady she encountered in 1998 while working as a writing mentor with the London-based Medical Foundation for the Care of Victims of Torture.
I work with many clients and try to find a sensitive way to elicit their story and find the form and help them with their language and you know, encourage them and give them a sort of a safe place in which to write.
Often observing how helpful it was for survivors of torture to put their experiences on paper as a kind of purging, Linden stayed with the Medical Foundation for 7 years, 6 years longer than she had originally intended. Linden says she witnessed how writing and creativity can be a healing force for refugees who are completely out of their culture, in an alien world, struggling to survive. This interaction with refugees was a springboard for Linden's play, a piece that in just 2 years has been produced nearly 20 times in the United States.
We all stayed together the whole night, and in the morning, there was a knock at our door. We saw it was our neighbors, and my father thought, this is maybe good. They will help us hide. Then we saw the others. 8 or 9 of them with machetes. What is going on? He said. Our next door neighbor, he said. Now is the time for all of the Tutsi cockroaches to die.
Featuring Miriam Hyman as Juliet, I Have Before Me a Remarkable Document recounts the Rwandan character's memories of the 1994 genocide as told to Simon, a once well-regarded poet who is mentoring the young writer. People's Light and Theatre production director David Bradley says exploring the subject matter of the play brought to him a realization that
there's a lot I didn't know, and a lot that I had just the glancing knowledge of, and that was humbling to really go, wow, I remember what I was doing in April of 1994, and it wasn't reading about this.
Bradley is not alone in having been largely unaware of the Rwandan genocide in 1994. Many, including then-President Clinton, have since expressed regret for not having done more about the crisis. Even for those who were more acutely aware of what was happening, the magnitude and brutality of the butchery was hard to believe. Actor Miriam Hyman says one of the most difficult parts of preparing for her role in the People's Light production was researching the bloody context of the story.
Just me understanding the event that took place, I mean, that was so major. It still blows my mind. I mean, I have dreams about, you know, what has gone on just from images that I've seen and footage that I've seen.
Hyman says in reality, she'll never really completely understand what took place. But David Bradley says the play at least invites audiences to think about how they view world events.
You can't say a play is going to change it all, but I think the act of paying attention to a story and thinking about the ways you can be open to some experience other than yours, I think that's worth the time.
I Have Before Me a Remarkable Document isn't transfixed on genocide. The play tracks the relationship between Simon and Juliet, the two writers in the story. This involves humorous cultural blunders and examines problems common to so many refugees. Alan Jacobson heads up several Philadelphia-based graphic design firms and is a partner with the Rwanda Healing Project, regularly leading community arts and health initiatives in a genocide survivor's village in central Rwanda. In tandem with the People's Light Play, he'll be taking part in a dinner and discussion on June 15th that will benefit the Rwanda Healing Project. Jacobson says over the course of his 6 visits to Rwanda since 2004, he's observed that after escaping the immediate danger, one of the biggest hurdles refugees face is starting over with essentially nothing.
It's redesigning your life, because I know that all of their lives were different before the genocide. And many of these people had homes, families, and the problem is, where do you begin? What do you start with? Where's that twig of opportunity that begins the process of your next life?
Oftentimes, beginning anew involves learning a new language and culture, finding work, dealing with the trauma of what was experienced, and combating loneliness, according to Sonia Linden. The daughter of refugees from Nazi Germany says the plight of so many that have fled difficult and dangerous circumstances gives her high hopes for her play.
We do still have the survivors of so many brutal regimes living amongst us. And I think if I have a mission, it would be to raise awareness and compassion amongst host communities, so that when they're sitting next to somebody on a bus speaking in a broken language, who may well come from one of these countries, to think twice before tutting or being impatient or being intolerant.
Linden says this kind of empathy can unveil amazing and inspiring stories of resilience among refugees from Rwanda and elsewhere.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The People's Light and Theatre's production of I Have Before Me a Remarkable Document Given to Me by a Young Lady from Rwanda runs through June 22nd. Over the years, the harpsichord has inspired exalted insults. The instrument's sound has variously been compared to a fork running across a birdcage or skeletons copulating on a tin roof. So it was in generations past when Wanda Landowska and Leopold Stokowski, heard here in a 1945 recording, played Handel their own way. Far more historically enlightened performances are heard today and tomorrow at Brandywine Baroque's Dumont concerts, where harpsichordists David Maroney, Karen Flint and Adam Pearl come to terms with instruments made as long as 4 centuries ago. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports from the climate-controlled concert venue known as The Barn at Flintwood.
The rolling hills outside Wilmington are the unlikely meeting point this weekend of what might be called the harpsichord community, a collection of audiences and musical archaeologists who are likely to discuss how the instrument creates its sound, how the sound begins and ends, and even whether or not the feathers on the plucking quills came from vultures. Normally, those who love this instrument, whose heyday stretched from the 1600s to the late 1700s, must be content with historic reproductions of the originals. Brandywine Baroque's artistic director Karen Flint has 9 authentic harpsichords from the period, and that's something, considering the harpsichords don't have a very high survival rate. Because they were an emblem of social class, the instruments were targets of destruction in the French Revolution. The Spanish Civil War left only 14 intact in that country. Hearing them now is something close to musical time travel. Of course, any given instrument is bound to have sounded and been heard rather differently 400 years ago. Still, there's a special authority to these instruments that you don't have with the most faithful modern reproductions, says Berkeley-based harpsichord builder John Phillips.
What you get is its story, its history. It really is a voice from the past, from another era. Even with new strings, it's the old wood, mostly the old wood. And this one, even though there have been some modifications to it, it's now 2 keyboards, as you see, and it was built with 1. It's, in fact, very little of the sound box was ever touched. In fact, it wasn't ever opened until I did it. It was like getting a Stradivari violin that has never had its top taken off.
Philips was delighted to restore the 1635 Rucker's harpsichord from Antwerp after it surfaced in a 1997 Paris furniture auction. At that time, the instrument inspired a lot of skepticism from experts. Instead of the usual two strings plucked for every one note, this one had three. Philips concluded it to be a genuine Rucker's harpsichord, but an experimental one. And the instrument's owner, Karen Flint, says that third string has subtle advantages.
Well, it gives you a little more flexibility. You have two, you know, very different eights. One is plucked in a different place than the other, and so they've got slightly different sounds. One's mellower, one's a little more nasally sounding. And you can get a larger sound, but it gives you more variety, more choice of what you're going to do.
These particular harpsichords are remarkably supple in what you can do tonally with them. I mean, this will come as a surprise to someone who thinks, well, the harpsichord has mechanically can only make one volume. That's actually not true at all. And as you learn to play these, you discover, oh, well, I can do this, and I can make it sound like this. And you can create the illusion of huge dynamics when, in fact, in cold, hard fact, there aren't any. So these are illusion machines.
The manner of harpsichord playing has evolved in recent decades. Striking the notes of a chord individually, arpeggiating them, in other words, is just one means of giving added texture to music that once sounded one-dimensional. Moroni, in particular, creates a sense of friction within the music's inner layers. His phrasing has grown less strict over the years, full of flexible tempos that give the attenuated cadences in this piece by Jean-Henri d'Anglebert a sense of endless rhapsody. This harpsichord and that music are likely to have known each other in the mid-1600s, and if so, are being reunited after a very long hiatus. Much of the music from this period seems to have been lost. However, a collection of some 110 pieces, known as the Borel Manuscript, has surfaced in recent years. You would think that one of the manuscript's longtime owners, the great French pianist Alfred Cortot, would have recognized the value of what he had. Apparently not. The University of California at Berkeley bought the manuscript around 2002. Since then, David Moroni, who is on the faculty there, and Karen Flint have been finding their way through it, discovering that most of the music hadn't survived in any other source. Flint finds a certain thrill in reading music on the very page where it was copied so long ago.
The manuscript itself tells you so much about a piece, and just the layout on the page gives you an idea of what the composer is thinking. And somehow or other, when you see music that's modern printed music, it kind of homogenizes everything.
Music from this manuscript will be featured in this weekend's concerts and is yet another manifestation of the dynamism to be found in many quarters of the early music movement. Once considered an arcane collection of musicians who didn't know how to play their instruments very well, it's now a wholly satisfying musical universe. Long-lost or unknown music that's worthy and charming is being constantly reclaimed. Performances approach the composers on their own terms and with great specificity of style afforded by instruments from the same time and place. European nerve centers of this activity in Holland and Belgium are brimming with new ideas. Performances have an almost improvisatory sense of invention and one that's so often absent from the symphonic mainstream. We didn't know what we were missing.
Philadelphia Inquirer music critic and columnist David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Brandywine Baroque's Dumont concerts in today's Philadelphia Inquirer. Performances take place today and tomorrow at the Barn at Flintwood in Centerville, Delaware. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Anne-Marie Mulgrew and Abby Gala. Creative Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.